The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate
to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money through free checking accounts
and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union,
encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, sitting in for Virginia Prescott. Earlier this week, I totally geeked out when I found out that SpaceX, Elon Musk's private space venture, successfully landed stage one of their Falcon rocket on Cape Canaveral less than an hour after launching it and 11 satellites into space. My dad loves to talk about how he watched the moon landing live on television. And while, no, I did not catch the SpaceX web stream as it happened, the enthusiasm was just as infectious when I watched it online the next morning.
Stage one is landed.
LZ-1, the Falcon is landed. Landing operators moving to procedure 11.100, section 3 on LZ-1. Be net, recovery net.
Repeat, the Falcon.
Now, if you haven't been following SpaceX and their mission to create a reusable rocket, this is truly an incredible moment in space travel, because rockets, they are really expensive. In March, Musk pointed out during an interview with Bloomberg Business that replacing a rocket that's been ditched after use costs $60 million. Refueling a reusable rocket costs maybe $300,000. So if this achievement can be perfected and repeated, going to space just got a hell of a lot cheaper. Granted, it may not have been as sexy as stepping foot on the moon, but I will always remember what I was doing when I watched a GIF of the Falcon coming back to Earth. I was lying in bed, staring at my smartphone, laughing out loud with excitement. Now, just about a year ago, I was substitute hosting Word of Mouth, talking about how the private space industry was in trouble. At that time, SpaceX and Virgin Galactic had both suffered big setbacks, and the media was questioning whether we can truly overcome the technical barriers that stand in the way of cheap commercial spaceflight. Well, now we have a little momentum in that direction, but what about the psychological and physical barriers? Sydney Brownstone is a staff writer for the Seattle newspaper The Stranger. She's also a contributor to Fast Company, where she wrote about the often ignored mental side of space travel. I spoke to her last year. So, Sydney, it's worth pointing out that you're not really writing about the mental pressures on people who would, say, travel to Mars and maybe be on a spaceship for years at a time. You're looking at the side effects experienced by pilots who are flying suborbitally. That's at very high altitude. So tell us a little bit about the phenomenon that you describe, this break-off phenomenon.
Right. Well, I think it'll be helpful to contextualize the break-off phenomenon in another type of syndrome I stumbled across called the overview effect. This is a syndrome or an experience that, the CEO of Virgin Galactic, George Whitesides, is invested in. There's something called the Overview Institute. Basically, it's this idea that when you pay for space travel, anyone can go up and have this really beautiful epiphany about the fragility of the Earth and the unity of humankind. And it's supposed to be incredibly emotional and intense. In a very positive way. This is one of the selling points. Some space tourism companies actually use it in their marketing materials. So I knew about this overview effect, and when I started interrogating it a little bit and going through the medical literature, I came across another kind of parallel syndrome called the break-off phenomenon. And this is something that was first reported in 1957 in a paper that interviewed 137 fighter pilots. And this is a term they came up with themselves, the break-off phenomenon. It was this feeling of when they would get up to high altitudes, the feeling dissociated or separated from the Earth. And dissociation is not a term to be taken lightly. It's a very, very, it can be a very scary feeling.
This is sort of what the out-of-body experience.
Right. And the weird thing about the break-off phenomenon, too, is that it wasn't it wasn't always positive and it wasn't always negative. So two-thirds of the pilots who did describe breakoff described it as something calm and peaceful. A few felt closer to God. And then there were about a third of the pilots said they freaked out, basically.
Yeah. Well, how does the breakoff effect manifest physically? I mean, we're talking psychologically about people, you know, feeling very calm or feeling closer to God. But what is happening to their bodies?
It's hard to say. You know, a lot of people report a variety of effects. In the medical literature, I found one case of a squadron commander who was hyperventilating and basically displaying the symptoms of a panic attack or several panic attacks. You know, he would get this tightness in his chest. He would lash out at his coworkers. And those kind of all seemed like symptoms he developed after experiencing the breakoff phenomenon. But I think that the main symptom is this feeling of dissociation. You feel separated from the earth, which if you think about it, can be a really positive thing. Oh, I feel free. I feel surreal. And then it can also feel extremely unsettling.
And what happens when this occurs? I mean, they're experiencing something, but how does that affect their ability to fly?
You know, there have been a lot of different conclusions. When we first started flying astronauts and cosmonauts, NASA and the Russian Academy of Sciences, they were very concerned about breakoff happening to astronauts and ruining missions. But some researchers concluded that it just wasn't a big deal and it didn't affect someone's ability to fly. On the other hand, we have this other term called spatial disorientation, and breakoff is kind of one symptom in a constellation of weird things that can happen to you when you're flying, and it does cause pilot error, and you know, quite a few people have died because of it.
Now, does it seem like there's a pattern of maybe who experiences breakoff?
Well, the very early researchers made a few connections, and they're a little bit hazy, but if you had a history of mental illness, if you were just having a rough time on Earth, basically, you were more likely to experience the negative effects of breakoff. And one researcher I spoke to who was working on an Air Force base in the 80s and 90s, worked with pilots very closely who didn't really want to tell her about breakoff and didn't want to tell her about their feelings at first. But when they opened up, they told her that some of the traumas and stresses they experienced on Earth would become magnified in flight. For example, a pilot who recently lost his son and his wife was flying, and he heard their voices. When he heard their voices, he realized that he was spiraling into a dive. He had made a very dangerous mistake, and he was able to pull himself out of it, but this is something that rattled him. And, you know, I think a lot of people have different experiences based on, I don't know, just their personalities, their experiences, the things that occupy their minds.
I'm speaking with Fast Company's Sydney Brownstone about the influence of space travel on mental health, specifically a phenomenon referred to as the breakoff effect. Now, you mentioned in your article that this phenomenon seems to have disappeared from the literature anyway in the 70s. Was it so hard to pin down? Partially, you mentioned that pilots are skeptical to talk to psychiatrists. Is that part of the issue?
It's hard. It's hard to pin down. There's definitely something called the lie to fly culture, which is the idea that if you're a pilot or you're an astronaut, you don't want to say anything to your flight surgeon that's going to ground you and ruin your career. If you say, well, I was flying at 70,000 feet in a U-2 spy plane, and I thought I heard the voice of my dead son, you know, the flight surgeon might think that you're not able to do your job. If you go into space because of G-forces or because of the ergonomics of the ship or, you know, just how our bodies are built, astronauts will puke. This is something that space tourists will almost certainly experience, too. A lot of space tourists will throw up for certain. But astronauts didn't want to show this to their flight surgeons for a very long time, so they tried to hide the fact that they were throwing up in space. So the fact that this disappeared in the 70s could be in part due to lie-to-fly culture. You know, as the space shuttle program was ramping up, NASA didn't want to cast the idea of an astronaut as someone who was vulnerable.
Well, I suppose the difference for space tourism is that you might be paying $250,000 to throw up in space. But astronauts, you know, they do go through these rigorous physical and mental tests to be able to determine whether or not they're fit for space travel. What about civilians who may pay in the future to go on these suborbital flights? Are they going to be tested in the same ways?
It's hard to tell because there's nothing really regulating this type of activity at the moment. But I did get the opportunity to visit a space training center called NASTAR, which has trained the first Virgin Galactic and X-Corps space tourists. And what they offer is a two-day training program to acclimate a person to G-forces. These are the acceleration forces that a person will feel both vertically and horizontally as they're going to space. So no, they are not subject to the same type of rigorous, you know, psychological, physical testing as astronauts were. And it's a completely different culture, too, because now, or presumably in the next couple of years, anyone who can afford space travel can go up. A lot of the selling points for these companies are, you know, you don't need to have a specialized background. We'll take you. We're making that available to you.
Well, does that seem okay to you, given that these are people that aren't going to be behind the controls? So maybe they can experience the breakoff phenomenon, but it won't be devastating because there's no chance that they'll spiral downwards and crash the plane.
Given the reporting that I've done, I do have concerns about this attitude being kind of cavalier and not communicating the fullness of the experience to these space tourists. Because if you're selling the overview effect, you're selling one kind of experience. It's going to be positive. It's going to be an epiphany. You're going to realize all these things about the Earth and your duty to protect it. It's got kind of this manifest destiny environmentalist slant to it, which you would think is positive, but without communicating the fact that you might go up there and your traumas or stresses might be magnified. I think it's important to say that there's a range of experiences a person could have, and we should be open to that.
Well, Sydney, thank you so much for taking time to explain this to us. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Taylor.
Sydney Brownstone is staff writer for the Seattle newspaper The Stranger. She's also a contributor to Fast Company, where she wrote about the often ignored mental side of space travel. You will find a link to her article at wordofmouthradio.org. When it comes to space, the public tends to steer towards the big questions. Is there alien life out there? When are we going to Mars? But the world of astronomy is full of curveballs, important questions and insights that we, the public, do not realize are a big deal. Gabe Spitzer is host of WBEZ's Clever Apes. In this story, he learns about some of those big curveballs, and he shares them with us.
Mark Hammergren is an astronomer, but you can think of him more like an archaeologist. He's trying to recover the lost history of how our planets formed, and it's a much more brutal story than we used to believe. His quarry is a near-extinct race of wannabe planets, actually large asteroids called planetesimals.
People like to think of asteroids as just chunks of rock and metal in space, and that's it. But really, once you get up to tens of miles, hundreds of miles across, these things really are little worlds in their own right. They're little planets, in a sense.
Hammergren works at Chicago's Adler Planetarium. Those asteroids were the seeds of our planets. Big, hot rocks that fuse together to make a Venus or an Earth or a Neptune. A telescope in New Mexico scans the asteroid belt, and Hammergren's group analyzes the reflected light for signs of planetesimals.
Okay, where are they?
That's a really good question.
It turns out they are not that easy to find.
There once were perhaps 100, maybe even 1,000 times as many asteroids there between Mars and Jupiter that have subsequently, from the formation of the solar system, been lost.
There is now exactly one asteroid left that's recognizable as one of those planet seeds, at least as far as we know. So instead, Hammergren is searching for fragments, chips of the planet kernels lost to history. To understand why they're so scarce, we first have to chuck out the neat and peaceful story that many of us learned in school about how the planets formed.
The conventional wisdom is kind of an astronomy 101 view of our solar system. You have this cloud of gas and dust coalescing together. Planets begin to clump up and form, and pretty soon you have the solar system we see it today. It's a very orderly and simple process. Didn't happen like that, of course. Is far more complex, far more violent, far more loss.
Scientists now think it was a lot less gentle merging and a lot more smashy-smashy. Jupiter was quite the cosmic bully, ranging around like a bull in a china shop, sending rocks and debris crashing into each other. Our naive picture of Jupiter, the gentle giant, has now been pulverized thanks to new technology.
What's really changed is just the power of computers.
Yoram Lithwick is an astrophysicist at Northwestern University. He says the evolving solar system was highly complex. Each moving body had gravity that affected many others. So only lately, as computer models have matured, has the true picture begun to emerge.
People can now simulate thousands of bodies orbiting the sun and interacting with each other, whereas before it was very costly even just to simulate the solar system with only the eight planets.
The models now suggest not only did those bodies grind each other to dust, most were kicked out of the solar system completely. Now it gets really interesting. Mark Hammergren calls them rogue planets and says they may still roam the galaxy.
Could our solar system have exported planets into interstellar space 4.5 billion years ago? And if our solar system did it, countless other stars and generations of stars before us must have done that.
We head upstairs from his office into the planetarium's solar system gallery. Scale models of the planets hang from the ceiling. Hammergren points out the asteroid belt, his hunting ground for vanished planetesimals. And he demonstrates how Jupiter's romp through the primordial mosh pit could have whipped planet after planet into the emptiness of interstellar space.
Space should be just absolutely rife with these kinds of things.
I hope it is.
I hope it is, too.
And I hope some of them have aliens on them.
They may very well. You could take the Earth and remove it from the sun, and there would still be internal heat driving things like hydrothermal vents beneath the oceans. You could still have life on a planet like that, completely independent of a star.
And that, lost worlds of alien creatures, exiled from orbit and sailing through empty space, would be quite the curveball indeed. Down the hall at the Adler, Chris Lintott heads up the Citizen Science Initiatives. One of those grew out of the reams of data produced by telescopes like the Hubble, including hundreds of thousands of pictures of galaxies. Scientists need eyes on those pictures to better understand the universe. And so the Galaxy Zoo was born, enlisting legions of people at their home computers to categorize the galaxies. But little did Chris Lintott know, the mother of all curveballs was headed his way.
We need to classify these images according to their shape. So we want to know if this is a spiral galaxy. We want to know which way the arms are turning. And all of these little bits of information tell us something about how the galaxy formed. But the problem is that to classify that, computers aren't up to the task. You need humans. So when people go to the galaxyzoo.org website, you very quickly get an image of one of these galaxies, and you're presented with a selection of buttons, and look closely and see if you can see any spiral arms. Well, one of the first things we thought we'd do, just as, you know, a sanity check, was to make sure that we were getting the same number of clockwise galaxies as we were counterclockwise. There's nothing in the universe that should have favoured one or the other, so it would be a real cosmic conspiracy if we saw more of one kind than the other. And to our surprise and our shock and slightly to our horror, we found we were seeing more counterclockwise galaxies. And this result makes no sense at all. It would be a fundamental property of the universe on the largest scales, which contradicts some of our most fundamental assumptions. You could possibly replicate this result if the universe is very small and shaped like a donut. I know when scientists say things like that, it's tempting to make them sound profound, but that idea is exactly as crazy as it sounds. But that was the kind of thing we were considering. And so this was really worrying. We thought, well, if this was any other piece of experimental apparatus, you'd have stripped it down, rebuilt it, and started again. And we can't really do that with the humans who are classifying for us, but we can play games with them. We took the galaxies and we flipped the images and showed them to people again. Now, if there were really more counterclockwise galaxies in the universe, then when we flipped them, we should see more clockwise galaxies. But they still said there were more counterclockwise galaxies. What we found, in fact, is that it's not the universe that's odd, it's us that's odd. There's something about spiral shapes when they're that way round that makes them easier to recognise. It's actually deeply wired in the human vision system or in the human brain. Just as pure scientists, we could measure it, account for it, and go on and do the rest of our science. But we also began looking around, of course, for reasons why this might be, and we started cold calling psychologists to say, have you ever heard of this effect? I spent a very interesting afternoon on the phone with a man in New York who spent his life showing spirals to monkeys. But I think the real explanation is that it's something to do with the way the right and left brain process images on the page. There's a famous example of this called the ballerina illusion. It's a rotating image of a ballerina, always turning in the same direction. But if you watch for long enough, you'll see her change direction. Your brain makes her flip. And we are seeing the same effect from our galaxy survey. One thing that popped into my head immediately, they wouldn't quite let me put it in the paper, but there's a Shakespeare quote in which, in Julius Caesar, he says, "The fault, dear Brutus, lies not in the stars, but in ourselves."
Chris Lintott heads up citizen science at the Adler Planetarium. I caught him in Oxford, where he does research, and he hosts the BBC series Sky at Night.
That was Gabe Spitzer, host of Clever Apes from WBEZ. We all know the rules when it comes to creating passwords. Don't rely on basic personal information, use a combination of numbers, lowercase and uppercase letters, and most importantly, don't use the same password for everything. So how come so few people actually follow those rules?
The password I use now is my husband's shield number when he was in the New York City Police Department.
My password for so many of my websites includes a zip code of a place in the Caribbean where I hope to live someday.
But I decided to do my name, Dylan Ward, backwards, which was Knowledge Draw.
And then we realized we both use the same password. We both use our parents' phone number as our iPhone passwords.
Ian Urbina is an investigative reporter, and last year he wrote an article for the New York Times Magazine called The Secret Life of Passwords, an intimate portrait of our human need to attach meaning to even the most meaningless aspects of our lives. The article was accompanied by a series of audio interviews. You just heard excerpts from a few of them. And last year, I spoke with Ian about his story. So you started collecting people's passwords years ago. Do you remember the first one that made you realize you were onto something here?
Actually, I do, because there was an awkward, funny conversation I had with my cousin where we were talking about our passwords, and we both realized that we had what we now call keepsake passwords, ones that had meaning and sort of a funny reason for them. And mine was an embarrassing admission in that it was Kick Kelly, which was the name of, I'm going to sound horribly mean, but it was the name of the dog that we had. And he was a very frustrating dog, always doing things he shouldn't have been. And one day I had to set my password, and I was frustrated at the passwords and I was frustrated at the dog. And so I combined the two.
And so the idea being you wanted to kick Kelly, the dog.
That's right. I wanted to kick Kelly, and I wanted to kick the passwords. And so I thought I would codify it into a code.
Well, it's funny because as you write about this topic, you sort of tell the story of how a lot of these really personal passwords come out of frustration.
Yeah, I mean, the fascinating thing was the range. You know, so some folks seem to have motivational passwords, you know, kind of the time they wanted to run in the half marathon, or, you know, to quit smoking, or, you know, a reminder to call their mother. Others had a built-in venting mechanism where it was a way to let off steam. And so it might be sort of a joke at the boss's expense, or a nickname for that person you really don't like. And it gives you a sort of chuckle each time you type it in. It's a sort of inside joke with yourself. So yeah, there's a real diversity in the purpose that people had buried in their password.
There's a few really haunting stories from the article. One of the most revealing for me anyway, comes from a woman that you spoke to, I think just on a park bench, a stranger. And she told you that after her son died, she discovered his password contained a secret that she had never known. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I mean, it was both a really poignant interaction. In some ways, I marveled that she was telling me this. But the password was Lambda69. And the story was that her son had committed suicide several years earlier. And she had been going through his room and had found a piece of paper at his desk with his password on it. And she, at the time, didn't know anything about Lambda or 69, so she went on the internet and soon started realizing that Lambda is a common historical signature, you know, symbol in gay history, and 1969 is the date of the Stonewall riot,
right.
A key moment, and she started realizing that her son had been gay, something she had not realized before his death.
It seems like this is such a difficult subject to get people to open up about. I mean, we all know we're supposed to keep our passwords secret, and yet you spoke to people on airplanes, this woman on a park bench. Did you have a strategy for talking to people to get them to open up?
That was sort of one of the surprises that kept me going all the while. It was that people were willing, even eager, to tell me these stories, and I couldn't figure out why for the longest time. And I still don't know for sure, but I have a theory. My strategy typically was just to tell them the notion that there's this subspecies of passwords that are not like the rest. They're emotionally imbued and they have a backstory to them. And once it crystallizes, people would register and realize that that spoke to them, and indeed they had one of their own. And my theory was that, you know, people were willing, eager to do that, partially, I think, because there's a collective frustration and tension that we all experience, both from the overload of data in the current moment that we live with, and also just sort of a pervasive fear that is real and legitimate, but hugely weighing on us, a fear of, you know, that we might get hacked. And those two things put pressure on us, and I think there's this cathartic moment that came in these conversations where people said, you know what, I don't care, I'm just going to tell you this, even if I have to go and change my password afterward.
There's one incredibly moving story from the article, and I want to play the audio here. This is an interview with Howard Lutnick. He was chief executive of the financial service firm Cantor Fitzgerald.
Cantor Fitzgerald employed 960 people on the 101st to the 105th floors of the World Trade Center. The plane came in below our floors and eliminated any way that they could get out of the buildings. We lost every single person who was at the office that morning. I said, look, we have two choices. We can close the firm and go to our friends' funerals. 700 funerals, which is 20 funerals a day, every day for 35 straight days. Or we'd probably have to work harder than we'd ever worked before to try to save the firm. The words that came out from everybody were unanimous. They were going to do everything they possibly could to help the families of those who were killed. And the only way we could help them would be to have a company. Our main computers were in the World Trade Center. We have these backup computers. You need passwords to bring them up, but the people who had the passwords were killed. When trying to figure out what the passwords are, you just couldn't ask someone a business question. It didn't feel appropriate, and it wasn't appropriate, but you know, for me to talk to the family was natural and important to me. When you actually understand, you can have a conversation that's entirely different than other people. I couldn't communicate with them in the same way if my brother hadn't been killed. At some point, towards the end of the conversation, I would say, I need to turn my systems on so I can rebuild the company. And they would tell us stuff. And you know, and I would always ask, did he have a nickname? Because sometimes I had learned that people use nicknames as their passwords. And, you know, when you ask a widow, you know, 2 days after her husband was killed, you know, did he have a nickname? And they'd say something like, you know, Batman. And, you know, they would laugh. And so we would have all sorts of conversations, you know, just looking for things that would assist in giving us an area in which to try to break in. And really, for the first 48 hours, what we did is we broke into our own computer system to rebuild the company so we could take care of our friends' families.
I'm talking about digital passwords as personal keepsakes, and joining me is Ian Urbina. He's an investigative reporter for the New York Times. And that story you just heard came from Howard Lutnick. He's chief executive of the financial service firm Cantor Fitzgerald. Now, that story is so haunting, and it makes me think about the fact that a password is a secret. And so for your password, instead of a random assortment of numbers and letters, people often choose to really reveal secrets about themselves.
in some ways, these are the anti-password passwords, right? So they're not disposable. They're not anonymized. You know, they're not meaningless. They are surprisingly poignant and pretty and personal. And in that Cantor Fitzgerald anecdote, you know, you see that the very thing that we're not supposed to do, the very thing that makes our repertoire of passwords weak, these keepsake passwords, are the very thing that allowed that firm to stay alive.
Was part of your hope with this article, and I'm going to call it a project because it seems like collecting all these passwords is more than just a story, but was part of the idea to document them before they disappear? I mean, it seems like experts all sort of agree that the future of security has more to do with thumbprints and digital keys than it does with passwords, these, you know, random collections of digits.
Yeah, I mean, that was another epiphany along the way, right? That we are immersed in passwords. I think the average person has 40 or so in their life, and we live now. And so we can't think of a time where there wouldn't be passwords. But most people I talk to sort of who take a long dure view of it point out that, number one, your grandparents or great-grandparents didn't have passwords of this sort, certainly not as many, and your great-grandchildren probably won't either. So this is a blink in history when passwords are this universal burden that much of the globe suffers. And that struck me as sort of interesting anthropologically. You know, we should study it a little, this institution, the password, the digital password, and also not just study it from a security perspective, but also look at it from, you know, where's its humanity and its illogic and rationality. And so that was part of the goal.
Do you want to share your passwords at all?
I don't. I'm not a digital nudist, as we described in the story, someone who's willing to just throw all care to the wind and put their password out there. I think I'll keep mine secret.
Ian Urbina, investigative reporter for The New York Times. There's a link to his incredible article, The Secret Life of Passwords, at wordofmouthradio.org. And Ian, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thanks for having me.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. If you've ever dreamed of publishing a novel, or a memoir, or anything really, chances are you've also read work by a favorite author and asked, how on earth do they do it? From finding the time, to keeping on task, writing is an incredibly personal and often very mysterious process. Well, not anymore. The 10-Minute Writer's Workshop is a new podcast hosted by Virginia Prescott, where she interviews authors not about their books, but about their process, their worst distractions, and their best advice for aspiring writers. It's available now on iTunes or wherever you download podcasts. And today we're going to listen to an episode with the best-selling creator of the number one Ladies Detective Agency series.
I'm Alexander McCall-Smith, and this is the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop.
So which do you think is harder to write? Is it the first sentence of the book or the last?
I think the first sentence is probably harder and is immensely important because in many cases that's the only sentence somebody's going to read. And so you have to be very, very powerful in your first sentence, and that one hopes will get people to read the rest of the book. So I think that is more difficult. The second sentence, or not the second, but the last sentence, you have more time to think about. And of course it expresses the resolution in the novel. And so I think it's easier.
Do you sit down with that first sentence in mind, or what is your process? Sitting and it comes to you, or planning and then you sit?
I often, interestingly enough, I've often written the last sentence in the book before I begin the book. I'd not really thought about this before you started asking me these questions about it, but I will sometimes write the final sentence. I've got a sense of how things are going to resolve, and that comes to me. As far as the first sentence is concerned, I think you just have to jump in to it. I don't sit there and plan it too extensively. I sit down and it comes. I think a lot of writing involves getting in touch with one's subconscious mind. And I think the subconscious mind is often the source of fiction. And therefore, many of the sentences that are going to appear in the book are there, made by the subconscious mind. And you just really have to facilitate their expression.
As a now seasoned writer and confessed serial novelist, are there any habits that you would encourage a new writer to pick up or even to avoid?
I think what I would say to a new writer, to an aspiring writer, is firstly, have the courage of your convictions and write from the heart. I think that's very important. Don't try and write what you think other people are going to want you to write, because that will mean that what you produce isn't really authentic to you. So write from the heart. Rely on the heart. Rely on your judgment. And then, as far as the actual process of writing, I think what you have to do is you have to sit down and apply yourself. Never wait for the muse to come and tap you on the shoulder, because the muse doesn't do that. And you will sit there for a long time, or you'll get up and do something else. So have a regime and write. Set a target. I think that if you can set a target of 500 words a day or 1,000 words a day, whatever your appropriate number is, and try to do those. You can always abandon them and score them out, but I think a regime and a program, an organized program, is very important.
Do you edit as you go, or you wait until the end?
I tend to do comparatively little editing. I find in my case it tends to come out in fully formed. I will do a certain amount of editing. Probably I do that when I've finished a chapter. I'll go back and look at it rather than edit as I go along. But generally speaking, it comes out in the final form, and it comes out quite quickly. I write 1,000 words an hour when I'm writing, and I don't really have to sit there and think about what is going to be said. It just comes.
1,000 words an hour or a day?
An hour.
Wow.
I don't say it in any boastful way, but that's the way it works with me. I sit there and I go into what the psychiatrists would call, I suppose, a dissociative state. And I'm there, I'm aware of my surroundings, but it's coming from the subconscious mind.
What is your personal worst distraction from getting work done?
Well, I would have thought that for most writers now, I suspect that email is the problem. In that email is a constant way of being in touch with people and being distracted by people. And if you sit there and you think, well, maybe I'll just check my email. That's the road to ruin. Very. I think what you need to do is turn your email off. In fact, that's advice that I would give to a new writer, is turn your email off. Don't let email distract you from what you're meant to be doing.
And you said, for most writers, does this happen to you?
Well, yes, it does a bit, and I'm trying to control it. But I may be writing, and suddenly I think, is that an email I hear behind me? And you, to quote Shakespeare, although that was in front of him. But I think you really have to be careful about that. Apart from that, there aren't other great distractions for me. The telephone, obviously, can be a distraction, but not as insidious a distraction as email.
Are there books or other tools that you might recommend that aspiring writers consult?
Well, I think you don't really want to have too many reference works around you. You can check up on things. You've got your spell checker. Most people have got their spell checker turned on. That'll keep you right. Ignore the grammatical suggestions from a word processing program, because they're always really bizarre. They've got this extraordinary prejudice against the passive voice, and I find that very, very odd. So turn that off. Ignore the spelling check. You can deal with that later on. And just go ahead and write. Word processors are a wonderful, liberating tool for writers, because in the old days, when one was using a pen, it's a much more physical business. It's more tiring, your wrist gets more tired. I think you find it more difficult to put onto paper what thoughts are in your mind, whereas word processing, it's very, very easy. It's a fairly direct route into the mind.
You don't begin with pen, paper, you just go right to the computer and start.
I sometimes have a notebook in which I've noted certain things down, and I might have a very rough skeletal outline of the book. But generally speaking, I don't necessarily use pen and paper.
What was the best piece of advice about writing that you ever received?
I have been asked that, and I've always had difficulty in remembering it. I have received advice from people in the past. Problem is that I can't really recall particular pieces of advice that I have had. Maybe one piece of advice I had when I was writing academic works. I had a colleague with whom I did a number of books, and he quoted his English teacher of 100 years ago, who was called, I think, Mr. Robinson. And he said Mr. Robinson, who taught him how to construct sentences when he was 8, always said, never use 2 words when 1 word will do. And we talked about Mr. Robinson, and occasionally this colleague with whom I wrote these books would underline a word, and he'd in a draft that I'd done, and he would say, remember Robinson. And so there's Mr. Robinson in the background. I never heard his voice, but I hear what I think would have been his voice saying, do you really need 4 words there when you could cope with 1? And that, I think, is good advice. I think that you really should be sparing in your descriptions. By all means, use an adjective. We do need adjectives to do certain work. But don't put in too many. And I find these days, when I read a number of things, I find they're overwritten. People are just trying to be too smart and trying to be too grand in their prose. They could be much simpler in what they say. Well, when you're describing something, remember to leave it to the imagination of the reader, because the reader is going to have a picture of the scene, and the reader actually wants something to do. If you distract the reader by describing the minutiae, then that's going to make it a really rather a difficult process for the reader to envisage what you're saying. So all you need is a little brushstroke. If you're talking about the sky, you don't have to give a long description of what the sky looks like. You just say, a clear and empty sky. And you could even cut out the clear, Mr. Robinson would have, and you would just say, an empty sky. And indeed, if you're really being minimalist, you could cut out empty, just say the sky. And then the reader thinks of what the sky will look like, because most readers have seen the sky and don't really need you to describe it in great detail.
Well, thank you to Mr. Robinson and to Mr. Alexander McCall-Smith.
Now, shall I make a further statement?
No, that's it.
All right. Oh, well, okay.
That's it.
Oh, right, I was going to...
Unless you have one,
yes,
in mind.
Yes. I think we should discuss the vexed issue of whether men should use facial moisturiser.
At last, a meaty topic!
That was Virginia Prescott interviewing Alexander McCall-Smith for the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop. You can subscribe to the podcast in iTunes and hear more advice from other great authors, including Salman Rushdie, Stacey Schiff, Patti Smith, and many more. And that's it for today. Thanks for spending some time with us talking space and writing on what has got to be the warmest Christmas Eve in recent memory. Whatever your faith and level of holiday enthusiasm, we at Word of Mouth wish you a merry weekend and a happy short work week next week. If you wish it felt a little more like Christmas, let me recommend the Yule Log hour-long special by our beloved Sean Hurley and Morning Edition's Rick Ganley. I promise it will get you in the mood. There's a link to the show at wordofmouthradio.org. And if you're looking instead to avoid the spirit of the holidays, may I recommend binge-watching all of Jessica Jones on Netflix. I'm Taylor Quimby. Thanks again, and join us for more Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
Megan Tan, and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our volunteer is Pam Maroney.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.